Hi, I'm Alex Rum, an executive editor at Metro Magazine. Welcome back to Metrospectives. My guest today is John Ando, Mass Transit Administrator and GM at Hilion Transit in Hawaii. Today, John joins me to discuss what it's like running a transit agency on the island, what it's also like to run two other transit agencies at the same time, some of the innovative ways he's built ridership and built up stature in the community at some of his stops along the way, and the idea of fare-free transit. Thanks again for joining us. Hope you enjoy the conversation. Well, John, thanks for joining me today. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. And yourself, Alex?
I'm doing fine. Thanks. How's life on the island there?
You know, life in Hawaii has been amazing. We've done some great things with Hilion, rebranding our buses and making it more easier for people to take advantage of public transportation in this tropical environment. So it's been great. We've had volcanic eruptions as well recently.
Oh, wow.
And snow on our mountaintops.
Oh, that's crazy. We've had snow in California. So there you go. So you're a guy who wears a lot of hats. Can you talk a little bit about what else you do besides working with Hilion?
Yeah, so as the Mass Transit Administrator with Hilion, in addition, for the past 2 years, I've been the Interim Transit Manager for Link Transit in Burlington, North Carolina, for the city there. And then I'm also, for the last 23 years, been the Transit Manager for the city of Escalon, a small little rural town in Central Valley near Stockton in California.
Wow. So how do you find the time to juggle those three jobs?
You know, it's been a challenge at times, but I've been able to make it work. You know, Hawaii is six time zones away from North Carolina, so I can do North Carolina projects early in the morning before I start Hawaii work, or in the evening or on weekends. And Escalon, similar. I generally go to those places once a month to give FaceTime to the offices, but primarily do a lot of their projects remotely. They're small enough bus systems to where they don't require a full-time transit manager.
Yeah. And you know, you work with a lot of smaller agencies, a lot of agencies that kind of need, and, you know, kind of picking back up, you know, so to speak. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, what you come in and what you try to accomplish kind of short term and long term as you come into these smaller agencies, or these agencies that are kind of neglected by the communities as far as, you know, use?
Yeah, so mainly my specialty for the last 23 years I've been in transit has been rebuilding transit systems or starting new transit systems, setting the framework, making communities more excited or energized about public transportation, and then training somebody who can take over and maintain the system. I've never really been a maintainer. I've been more of a builder and right. Visionary and an implementer. So I've had a lot of fun in the various places I've been in the course of my career doing that.
And so, you know, kind of boots on the ground, you come in and what are some of the things that you're looking at implementing or kind of looking at and seeing where the transit agency actually is at that time and where you want it to get to?
Generally, I'm looking at how the network could be structured in a manner that's usable and easy for the community to use. I look at how we can market and engage the transit system to be a part of the community, such as like participating in safe place programs. Like when I was at the Comet, we did COVID testing and vaccination at Comet Central, partnerships with Uber and Lyft and other innovative programs, vanpooling as creative ways to increase ridership for the overall transit system and not just following the traditional means of a transit agency operating a bus or a van, per se.
Yeah. And I'm guessing community engagement, or I'm not going to guess, community engagement is a big part of that. Can you talk about when you come in, how you're able to kind of engage the community and kind of get a you know, a gauge of what they need and what they're actually looking for?
I've found basically making myself accessible to the community via my office phone, cell phone, has been rewarding because then the community feels like the transit agency is listening, promoting and encouraging the community to be active in the board and like coming to board meetings to express concerns so the board can hear what do we need to do to make the transit system accessible has been important. One thing I was happy that we did at the Comet is that we had the Comet Academy, where we actually train citizens to be active in public transit, civic opportunities. We taught them how the transit system is funded, why it's funded in this manner, why service is delivered in the way it's being delivered, how to apply to be a board member after going through this course, if they wanted to be appointed by one of the member jurisdictions. And overall, it's just like a public transit 101, because it may look easy that you just see a bus on the street and that's all that it takes to operate a transit system, but there's so much more behind the scenes.
Right.
And being a citizen and understanding how all those cogs work, I think is rewarding, getting effective to get what you want out of a transit system.
Yeah. And like a program like that, for instance, I mean, is that something that's easily implementable at other stops along the way, or is it kind of? Okay.
And I've strived to do some type of a civic engagement with the community at the various agencies I've been at, so that the public, I see public transit as this is the system that belongs to the public. So we want the public to be active in how we operate it, so that we can serve them more effectively and not become stagnant and eventually irrelevant.
And kind of, you know, hand in hand with that a little bit is kind of like a rebrand. I mean, do you typically come in and kind of rebrand the system, or are you working and trying to like kind of, you know, kind of rebrand the face of the system and kind of make people understand that we're here for you. We may not have been in the past, but here we go. Or are you changing the name of the service? You know, what kind of thing goes into kind of moving forward, you know, kind of giving a facelift to what, you know, they previously had in the past?
It really depends on what's going on with the brand of that system. Like in the case of Helion has been a name that people are very familiar with since the 70s when Helion first started, but it didn't truly have a good brand. And when I got there, we had buses that were donated to us from the bus on Oahu, mm-hmm. Maui bus on Maui. We had our own buses, but then the paint schemes were either Maui buses paint scheme, the gold from the bus, blue, green, red. So we were able to create a logo for the first time for Helion. Okay. That takes into consideration the island's flower, which is the lehua, which is basically a flower that grows after lava has flown, flown down the mountain, and it incorporated the colors of red and green. So the end result is this brand new fresh logo that we've applied on all 55 fixed route buses and 7 paratransit vans. So now there's a uniform brand that people can see island-wide. And it's actually been exciting to the extent that people are thinking that, oh my gosh, did the county get a new bus system? When really we just rewrapped the buses and just started promoting that logo more. Yeah. But it's created this new awareness that people are now thinking, we now have an island-wide public transit system that they never really thought existed before.
Right. And I would think that the, you know, your transit system out in Hawaii has kind of a unique set of challenges. You know, can you talk about some of those challenges the system is facing and kind of what you're doing to overcome those challenges?
Yeah, we've had several challenges. One, the island is 4,200 square miles. So it's about the largest island in the chain. And people live on the east and work on the west. So they'll spend upwards of 3 to 4 hours just to get to work for an 8-hour job to spend 3 or 4 hours to get back home. And we had a lot of our buses that were traveling basically around the coast, but we didn't have any that went across the island in the middle. So we created a new express route that started doing that. And the end result is we shaved off 2 hours of that travel time, which made it much more attractive. And we're starting to see ridership increase on that route. Another area of the island in Kailua Kona, we had a local bus route that was underperforming. And then the private interests, because they felt the transit service was inadequate, started a trolley. And they were funding that, but that was running every 90 minutes. We were able to work with the business improvement district there and the private businesses to consolidate their trolley into that underperforming local route. And now that route is one of the best performing routes in the system, utilizing a trolley on a 60-minute headway. And we're getting ready to expand that to 30 minutes. And the business community are just ecstatic to see how they're just seeing full buses, full trolleys going up and down Ali'i Drive. And it just shows that how we were able to engage the private community in funding a public system and marry two different demographic groups into one vehicle.
Tell me a little bit about how you did that. I mean, is it something, did they approach you? Did you approach them? You know, was it something that was kind of an ongoing conversation to solve this issue when you came aboard?
I approached them actually. And since we were getting ready to implement our master plan, we were looking at what would be the best way to engage some of these partnerships, also help fund some of the costs of it. We had tax dollars to pay for the expansion, but felt if we have the business communities vested in the service, then it's likely that they will help us in promoting. And also another challenge too is vehicles. Our fleet hasn't been replaced since our newest buses we purchased was in 2019. And that's kind of been a struggle for us as we're running donated buses that are 1995 Gillig Phantoms. So being able to bring some of the vehicles from that private operation also helped us being able to shift buses around to keep services going while we work aggressively to replace the entire fleet, which we were able to recently complete a fleet replacement plan.
Okay. Yeah. And that's one of the topics I think we wanted to talk about is, you know, the challenges of being a small transit agency and replacing your fleet. Can you talk a little bit about what kind of steps are going into that plan and kind of when you hope to have the fleet replaced by?
So, yes, it's definitely been a struggle. And fortunately, we've been aggressive in applying for FTA grants that we've been successful in receiving. So we're now in the procurement processes of basically buying these new buses. We just got four new commuter coaches from MCI delivered in January that just entered into service, replaced older buses from the 90s. We are about to get six Easy Riders from El Dorado, two new Flyers that will be also entering the fleet, and then two additional hydrogen buses that are being retrofitted that will also be added to the fleet. We are completing a procurement for battery electric buses, where we'll introduce five of those to the system. And then we just closed the procurement for 36 diesel hybrid and diesel commuter buses that will also hopefully be coming into the system once that award is made by late 24, early 25. So by the time all these bus deliveries have been completed, we'll basically have a fleet that is 2019 or newer. And all of the donated buses will basically be retired. And we've also developed a fleet replacement plan to help set the framework for the next 10 years on how we should replace the buses and how we should start applying for grants early on so that we have the cash flow available to order the buses and have them delivered when we start getting to the 12-year cycle for these new buses we just purchased.
Right. So the plan is to have all of the buses at the agency by next year?
That is correct. And then as part of that, since I mentioned we have diesel hybrid, we're going to then in our fleet transition plan to zero emissions, by 2032 to 2035, when those buses come up for retirement, we've already programmed either getting hydrogen buses or battery electric buses. So the state's goal is to be zero emissions 100% by 2045, where if everything works out to plan, we should be there 10 years earlier than the state's desire.
Oh, wow. And so I guess, you know, zero emissions is a big deal out in Hawaii, just kind of preserving everything that's there. And that's a kind of a big determining issue of why you guys are moving in that direction.
That is correct. Yes. And one thing, too, is because we have geothermal activity on our island, it's easy to produce hydrogen. So being able to use that energy and convert that to hydrogen makes it ideal for our buses that are traveling longer distances. And then we're focusing on the battery electric buses in the urban pockets of our island, Hilo, Kailua, Kona, Pahoa, Waimea, where we can put inductive charging facilities and have the bus every hour or every half hour hit those pads, get a quick charge, and then continue on their loops without having to pull the bus out of service.
And you mentioned, I think it was off camera, that you've seen, you've had a volcanic eruption there. Is that correct?
Mauna Loa recently erupted for about a 3-week period. Okay. And it hasn't erupted since the 80s.
And being from the States, I mean, what was that like for you? Did you, I mean, was it odd? Was everyone else just kind of like, you know, it's natural to worry about it? I mean, how did you feel?
It was natural, but don't worry about it. But there was also concern that if it had kept going, Hilo and Kailua Kona are on either sides of the island, and it could content the flow could potentially hit one of those communities and create disastrous effects. 2018, there was a flow from the Kilauea volcano at Hawaii's Volcanoes National Park that took out several hundreds of square feet in the Pahoa community and resulted in people being displaced, roads having to be reconfigured. Fast forward to 2023.
And I know, at some of your other stops, you've kind of and you mentioned at the top, kind of doing more to do more by doing other things. Can you talk about kind of starting partnerships with TNCs, bike shares, micromobility, how that's played a part in kind of filling gaps that maybe were there before?
Both at the Common End and Helion, it's been very rewarding to have those partnerships. Like on the bike share side, we can treat the bike share system almost as a bus route, and it's acting as the first mile, last mile connection for those that are trying to get from like a bus stop or a transit center to a business, to where it's just not cost effective to just send a bus out there,
Right.
and it provides active engagement on a person's health. Being able to do that. And we linked the two systems together to where you just ask the drivers for a code and you input that code in the bike share system and you get free, unlimited 30-minute bike rides throughout the entire day.
Wow.
The partnerships with the TNCs were more of acting as supplemental to the transit system, particularly at the Comet. It helped us with connecting people to grocery stores since there were a lot of food deserts in Colombia. And it also helped provide transportation at night when it wasn't cost effective to run a fixed route bus and paratransit service during those hours. In Helion's case, we're in the process of launching TNCs as part of our shared ride taxi program, to where people can use this program and we would subsidize up to $15.40 per trip. And they can use it as a way to connect to areas where there's little or no transit service or when transit service is not available. And it just provides those lifeline trip opportunities.
I remember too, speaking to you when you're at the Comet. I mean, implementing these services also can save the agency quite a lot of money, right?
Oh yeah, I mean the subsidies seem scary when it comes to like paying like $6, $8, or $15 per trip, but in the grand scheme of things, when you can convert those dollars to actually running a bus continuously on a path, whether it's every 30 minutes or every hour, and you're carrying less than 5 passengers per hour, it just doesn't make sense.
Right.
That's where flexible transportation comes into play, and it's just much better to do that.
Yeah, and with COVID and kind of post-COVID and talking about ridership, I think transit should start looking at these more and more, and I think we're seeing that happen more and more, right?
That is correct. And it's like this was a perfect opportunity to re-engage how you're going to run your public transit system by basically looking at what makes sense. Does the bus make sense? Or do these innovative opportunities like microtransit, shared programs with TNCs, volunteer transportation, bike share make better sense? And I'm starting to see that these other innovative opportunities make good sense for especially low density type areas.
I think looking at with post-COVID and looking at master planning, then are you looking at implementing more of these systems? I mean, is there hot spots other than kind of that commuter route that you'd mentioned earlier for Helion that you'd like to address and increase frequencies, or is it looking at more innovative solutions kind of fill areas that maybe where ridership is low and it doesn't make sense to use buses?
Since we're going through the master plan implementation, our next focus is looking at doing some type of on-demand microtransit services in these large subdivisions that are in the Puna and the Kau districts, where these subdivisions are upwards of 5 miles or greater, and where it's more effective to have a van that's circulating that could connect people to a hub where they can get fixed route transit than just circulating a bus every 2 hours in those areas, because we're not seeing the ridership materialize on those bus routes. and then also integrating Lyft and Uber into the shared ride program. So right now that program only operates in Hilo, once we get Lyft and Uber involved, we can now go island wide because Lyft and Uber vehicles are island wide, which now increases the accessibility of that program greatly.
I guess, you know, for other transit agencies and that sort of thing, I mean, how difficult are these partnerships to essentially set up, and how do you go about determining like what's going to work best, if it's going to be a microtransit or bike share or, you know, Uber, Lyft, you know, how do you make those determinations?
You generally look at existing data based on the demographics of the area, the ridership on particular services that are in place, the landscape, like particularly for bike share, to make sure that you have like appropriate bike lanes and destinations to serve, places to place the bike stations. And then that's kind of how you can make some good decisions on that. I'm also going through like a long range or short range transit plan to just look at the overall agency landscape and the service area that you're serving, and then using data to determine the best approach for what services are needed also is very helpful. And Hawaii County doing that in 2018, and then we just recently updated that master plan, was very helpful in basically seeing a 43% ridership increase by just implementing that plan alone. Whereas if we just had stayed status quo, we were seeing our ridership decline from 10 years ago, we were about 1 million passenger trips, to when I got to the agency in 21, we were at 294,000 trips. We're now at 573,000 passenger trips last fiscal year alone. And I suspect we'll get close to 700,000 this year.
Right. And you've only been at the agency a little bit more than a year. Is that correct?
Two years.
2 years. Okay.
Yeah.
Wow, so it's quite a transformation. And I know you had the same success at the Comet as well.
Right. And it was interesting at the Comet. I was there during the pandemic, but we didn't see significant ridership decreases because we had the various other programs like the Vanpool and the Lyft Uber, because that was at the time when people wanted to not be conjugated on buses. So we got innovative to find creative ways to keep moving those folks until we got out of the pandemic and then people returned back to the bus.
John, it's always great to talk to you. I think, you know, the last thing I want to talk about was kind of the idea of zero fares. And I know that there's a lot of hurdles in kind of implementing zero fares. One of them being, as everyone points out all the time, you know, when you call it free fares, it's not free. Someone's paying for it still. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, ideas to overcome those hurdles, and if you're looking at that sort of solution at Hylion?
Yeah, and I actually want to say each of the three systems I manage, all are fare free right now. And I could tell you that making the sell of going to fare free was very exciting to each of the various boards that I presented this to, because they saw this as a way to increase transit ridership, increase opportunity for the transit dependent community, because they will now reinvest their money back into the community by spending money at the grocery store, using it for educational purposes. And we eliminated a barrier that the money could be a barrier for people trying to get to school or trying to get to jury duty or trying to even get to a court appointment because they may not have the necessary funds to do it. It also helped people get back into the workforce because they didn't have to worry about the costs associated of getting to and from work.
Right.
We also, in selling it, we also looked at the cost to collect fares. Escalon had a 1% fare box recovery ratio. Hylion had a 5% fare box recovery ratio. And Link had a 2% fare box recovery ratio. It was costing us more money to collect the fares staff-wise, having the electronic fare boxes versus just abolishing the fare structure altogether and reusing that time for something else. In the case of Hylion, it is we use federal grants to cover the ARPA funds and the CRISA funds through December 31st of 2025. We did the same thing in Escalon, and we did the same thing at Link. And we're right now in the process of identifying funds, whether through our, like in California's case, Transportation Development Act, in Link's case, vehicle registration fees to cover that fare. Beyond once the grants have fully been expended. Hylion, we have a general excise tax, so through 2030, and we've determined that there's enough capacity to take on the fares. Should the council elect to continue that after December 31 of 2025?
Great. And do you think that's a solution for a lot of transit agencies, or for the industry in general? I mean, is it something you think they could catch on, nationwide, universally?
I think it can work well in rural systems and suburban type systems and small urban systems, because those are the systems that generally don't have high transit ridership compared to the urban systems. I think in the case of urban systems, it'll be exciting to see if Washington, D.C., for instance, is able to make that happen, because they'll be the first nation's largest city to be fare free. I know Kansas City has already done it and they're seeing great successes, but if DC can pull it, then definitely a New York, Chicago, San Francisco, San Jose could definitely do it too. But I think it's just a way to, I look at it as, if the library system is free and is a social service, just like public transit, why can't public transit also be free? And we treat it the same way we treat the library.
Well, great, John. As always, I appreciate your time. It's great talking to you.